Auhea oko e koka aha. Ina he kuleana I mua o kea aha ho o kolo kolo ki e ke hano hano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. E naoi mai, e malio mai, I lohe ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh, give your attention, and you shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-18-361, WW versus DS. Arguing for the petitioner, Richard E. Mitchell. Arguing for the respondent, Joanna C. Ziegler. Also appearing for the respondent, Robert H. Thomas. Argument on the merits.
All right, good morning and aloha. This proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. During the proceeding, should one of the justices have a question, they'll raise their hand and I'll recognize them at the earliest opportunity to ask their question. I'm going to ask our attorneys to introduce themselves in the order in which they'll be arguing. And at the beginning, I want to express on behalf of the court our appreciation to our attorneys today, all of our attorneys who are participating under the appellate pro bono program. We are very grateful for your service to the cause of justice in our community. And again, I'll now ask them to introduce themselves, beginning with Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you, and good morning, Chief Justice Breckenwald and Associate Justices. May it please the court, Richard Mitchell, appearing through the Hawaii Appellate Pro Bono Project.
Very well. Ms. Ziegler?
Good morning, Chief Justice and members of the court. Joanna Ziegler, representing respondent, and here with me at virtual counsel's table is Robert Thomas.
Very well. Good morning. Thank you. And I also want to acknowledge Circuit Judge Matthew Viola, who's sitting with the court today by reason of vacancy. Thank you, Judge Viola. Just to confirm, Mr. Mitchell, you'll have 20 minutes for your opening argument. And you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal. I will be giving you warnings with lights and tones when you get to that 10 minutes. Ms. Ziegler, you will have 30 minutes for your argument. And you also will see a light and hear a tone at the end of your allotted time. Mr. Mitchell, please proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I am Richard Mitchell, representing the petitioner of the father in this matter. Chief Justice and Honorable Justices, the facts in this case are, the petitioner filed a petition for paternity against respondent, the mother, and the Child Enforcement Agency, for the state of Hawaii on November 17th, 2016. The Second Circuit Family Court convened an evidentiary hearing on the father's petition on October 25th, 2017. On the first day of trial, during the cross-examination of the custody evaluator, Dr. Robert Simon, the presiding judge called for a lunch recess, which prematurely ended the custody evaluator's testimony and the court's ability to hear a substantial remainder of the evaluator's findings. At no time prior to the lunch recess did either party request an opportunity to engage in settlement discussions. And at no time during the trial did the judge mention settlement discussions or ask in open court whether either party desired engaging in settlement discussions. During the lunch recess, the judge met first with both the attorneys in his chambers. Then, without having asked for or obtained consent from the parties in open court to meet without counsel present, the judge met separately with each of the parties in his chambers, first with the father and then with the mother. During the meeting with the father, the judge made his settlement inclinations known before hearing the remainder of the custody evaluator's findings. Neither of the respective parties' attorneys were present with their clients during these in-chambers discussions. In addition, the parties neither spoke to each other nor discussed settlement during the lunch recess. Contrary to this fact, when the court was brought back into session at approximately 1 p.m., the judge asked if the parties had had a discussion. In response to which, mother's attorney, Ms. Ho, replied, "During the course of a discussion, yes, we have an agreement. Should I put it on the record?" After the court directed Ms. Ho to proceed, she replied, okay. I'm basically following the proposed order and making changes where they are. After the terms were recited, the family court stated, I think we're done here. Put it in writing, and I'll sign it. In its opinion, the ICA noted the following improprieties about the family court's proceedings. It wrote, quote, contrary to finding of fact 18, father's counsel never explicitly acknowledged agreement on the record. Family court did not ask father's counsel for the mother's counsel's statement, and that she was basically following the proposed order and making changes where they are, was accurate. The family court did not ask father or mother on the record whether they understood and agreed with the settlement terms that had been placed on the record, if they had any questions about what had just taken place, or if anyone was forcing, pressuring, or threatening either of them into settlement. Notwithstanding its observations, the ICA then quoted the Miho case and wrote, quote, clearly it was the duty of counsel, number one, not the court, to keep the clients reasonably informed about the terms and conditions of settlement. We presume in our review that he did so, end quote. In short, the ICA recognized the appearance of certain improprieties in the lower court's proceedings, but incorrectly presumed that the father's trial counsel could have fulfilled his duty and kept the father reasonably informed as to all the terms and conditions. However, the father's trial counsel did not receive prior notice on the record that the court would preempt the evidentiary hearing, initiate private discussions with the parties, and that counsel would be excluded from such court-initiated discussions. Well, the code of the
if I could, you know, the issue raised by father in the ICA related to whether the settlement agreement actually reflected the discussions that had taken place between the parties and actually accurately reflected the agreement. The ICA engaged on those issues. However, in the cert application, that's another a new issue has been raised by father, which relates to the procedure followed by the court in several respects, but including what would appear to be discussions between the court and the individual parties in private and with nothing on the record reflecting the agreement of counsel. Can you explain or what's your position as to why the court should address that issue since it hasn't been raised either in the trial court or the ICA and father was represented by counsel in the trial court?
The writ of certiorari refers to several instances where the court engaged in conduct that had the appearance of impropriety. And certainly addressing those issues would be important to the cause of justice. The agreement that the parties discussed after they came back from recess, both on the record and after the mother's counsel submitted the proposed agreement, didn't even reflect the discussion that the parties had on the record. There were numerous inconsistencies. And the trial record reflects that even the mother's counsel requested relief from the order that was eventually entered and subsequently withdrew the effort to challenge that agreement. I think both issues are relevant to the appeal now because they go towards the cause of justice in addressing, making sure that both parties received due process and the concerns raised by the court's failure to act in a proper manner should be addressed.
Justice Nakayama has a question.
Mr. Mitchell, what do you know or what could have been the trial judge's motive in separating counsel from their clients?
Justice Nakayama, I can't speak to the judge's motive. All I can really speak to is the risk of creating a coercive environment when a judge separates the litigant from their counsel and engages that litigant in a private discussion in chambers. In this instance, that risk is exemplified in a declaration submitted by the father and attached to the motion for reconsideration, where the father expressly states that as the judge in chambers, in private, without counsel present, made his recommendations, he, the father, disagreed with the judge. But because the judge was, and to use the father's words, adamant, and to use the father's words again, the judge was the ultimate decision maker, he simply capitulated. And so while that doesn't directly address the issue of motive, it does highlight the problem with separating the litigant from their lawyer in private discussions and in effect causing that litigant to feel as if they have no choice but to agree.
Justice Wilson had a question.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Mitchell, I wanted to ask your thoughts about Rule 2.9's applicability. This is of the Code of Judicial Conduct, because it does state that a judge shall not initiate, permit, or consider ex parte communications, except in civil cases a judge may, with the consent of the parties, confer separately with the parties and their lawyers in an effort to settle matters. So my question is, do you take the position that judges cannot meet with the parties individually, or is it your position that it has to be clear that the parties are consenting to meet individually and their attorney has to be present?
Thank you for the question, Justice Wilson. I do not take the position that judges cannot meet with the parties separately. I do, however, take the position that in this instance, the judge should have, prior to recess and on the record, stated clearly his intent to meet with the parties and should have requested and obtained consent to meet with the litigants without counsel present. In addition, it's my position that the judge should have, on the record, explained prior to the recess the role the judge was going to play in these discussions. None of that occurred. I do agree that judges have wide discretion to encourage settlement, and it's advisable if necessary, with consent of the parties and the lawyers, to meet with the litigants. But under these circumstances, prior to the recess, there was no request, there was no consent, there was no discussion.
Justice Wilson, we have a technical issue we needed to address. So I'm going to take a brief recess at this point, and we'll come back for your follow-up and then Justice McKenna's question. So the court will stand in brief recess. All right. Welcome back, everyone. Thank you. I apologize for the interruption. We had, as I mentioned earlier, encountered issues with our closed captioning as we broadcast to the Judiciary's YouTube channel. We haven't been able to resolve them. So what we will do is continue with our argument, and then we will, as soon as possible when the argument is completed, close caption and post to the Judiciary's YouTube channel so it can be reviewed. Again, sorry, Mr. Mitchell, you were in the middle of your argument. I think you had just finished with an answer, and Justice Wilson was about to ask a follow-up question. Thank you, everyone, for your patience with this delay. Justice Wilson, your follow-up for Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Mr. Mitchell, you were stating your position that you felt consent was not obtained, and therefore Rule 2.9 of the Code of Judicial Conduct wasn't complied with. But I wanted to ask you, assuming that consent was obtained, that there wasn't any objection that would suggest that consent wasn't contained, I wanted to ask your position with respect to Rule 2.6b. That is it your view that the judge said something that would have constituted a coercive approach that would have meant that the settlement was being coerced?
Thank you for the question, Justice Wilson. The record is silent as to obviously what the judge said in private in chambers. So I can't take a position on whether what the judge said was in fact coercive. However, to the extent the father has submitted, as he has, a declaration which relayed how he felt about the discussion, I can take the position that he felt that the judge was adamant, and as the judge was the ultimate decision maker, he really had no other choice but to accept what the judge said.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Mitchell, but I thought that there was in the record a description of a conversation in which the judge discussed the degree to which the father was going to be able to have overnights with his child.
Are you referring, Justice Wilson, to discussions that were on the record or discussions that were not on the record that might have created the possibility of coercion?
I think they were discussions off the record. This is something that was reflected by the father in describing what his conversation was with the judge.
I believe that is the case. There were certainly other components to what was discussed by the judge and the father in chambers. And it's the other components where we don't have a record that I'm actually referring to, in addition to the references that relate to the father's belief that he could have his son for as many nights as possible, which was not the judge's position. That discussion was one of several points communicated by the judge to the father in chambers, but that particular point is the only one where we have a record. So you're correct, Justice Wilson.
Justice McKenna, I believe you had a question that you wanted to ask.
Yes, I actually now have two questions. And my first question is more of like a practical question. Mr. Mitchell, are you aware of whether or not this is a relatively common practice in the Second Circuit in terms of family court? Do judges break trials and then say, we're going to try to settle in the middle of trial, try to say we're going to settle, I'm going to conduct a settlement conference now and settle this case?
Thank you for the question. I don't practice sufficiently enough in family court to be able to make a representation either way.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. And my next question then is, do you think that, I'm just wondering what you envisioned would have happened if the settlement discussions had been unsuccessful? Do you think that there's any way this trial judge could have continued with the trial without at least implicating Code of Judicial Conduct Rule 1.2, promoting confidence in the judiciary with respect to impartiality and avoiding the appearance of impropriety? How could a trial judge conducting a trial break the trial, say, I'm going to try to settle this case, and then what if this case didn't settle? Could the judge, I know, and I realize there's questions as to whether or not there was an effective settlement, but was the judge going to go back on and continue trying the case after the ex parte communications? Is there anything in the record to indicate what the judge intended to do if he had been unsuccessful in settling this case?
Justice McKenna, thank you for the question. No, I'm not aware of anything on the record that suggests what the judge would have done if the settlement was unsuccessful, the negotiations were unsuccessful. And perhaps if I could answer the question also another way, even if the settlement discussions were unsuccessful, the fact that the judge did not give the parties prior notice of the intent to hold settlement discussions, the fact that the judge nonetheless unilaterally terminated the custody evaluator's testimony, all those things still would lead to the same conclusion of appearance of impropriety, the denial of due justice, even if the settlement agreement had not been concluded.
On my earlier question, you know, we have a fairly high standard of when we look at review plain error in civil cases. In the Castro case, U.S. National Bank versus Castro, we talk about three factors, whether consideration of the issue not raised at trial requires additional facts, whether its resolution will affect the integrity of the trial court's finding of fact, and whether the issue is one of great public import. So again, father was represented by counsel at the trial, and of course, even after the trial, when he filed a motion for reconsideration, yet never raised the issue of coercion or improper ex parte contacts. Why should we reach those issues today, in your view, given this test?
Thank you for the question, Chief Justice Reckenwald. As I said earlier, I think it's important to the cause of justice that at this level on appeal, that where we find these instances of the appearance of impropriety, that in order to maintain our justice system, we nonetheless address them, even if the party's appellate lawyer or the lawyers in the lower level did not raise the issues. It would not be congruent with achieving justice if we know we have these challenges with the way the trial judge comported himself and nonetheless allow the decision to stand.
But what about a factual record? You know, if they had, if trial counsel had raised this issue, we could have a more developed factual record of what in fact happened in terms of whether there was any consultation with counsel about, you know, the ex parte contact. Is that something that we should take into account, or is that not a factor that you think is relevant, the ability or the lack of a developed record?
Well, I certainly think, how do I say this kindly, there was a missed opportunity when the parties went back on the record for trial counsel to clarify on the record what had happened. And certainly both the failure of trial counsel to point that out and the fact that there are clearly suggestions that something had happened on the record, off the record rather, are both factors to be considered by the court. I think I heard my audible ding there.
Well, would you like to reserve the remainder of your time and while we hear from Ms. Ziegler, or any other points you wanted to make now?
Yes, I will reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you, Chief Justice.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Ms. Ziegler, your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. The family court's involvement in the settlement negotiations between mother and father did not invalidate the agreement that was reached. The family court did what it was supposed to. It brought the parties together, they negotiated, and reached a compromise. There are no red flags here. If the totality of the circumstances show that a settlement agreement is voluntary, the court is not under an independent constitutional obligation to question the parties and double check. The parties should be able to come together and negotiate with the help of their counsel, and in this case, the custody evaluator and the family court judge, and reach an agreement, all while being on the lookout for impropriety or coercion. If this court were to adopt a bright line rule requiring that the family court independently question the parties on the record as to the voluntary nature of the settlement agreement, that would be at odds with this court's decision in Mijo, which sets forth a totality of the circumstances test. And even if this court were to create a bright line rule, this case is a particularly poor vehicle for doing so. And that is because father consistently requested that both the family court and the ICA actually enforce the settlement agreement that was entered onto the record. And he did so by pointing to the inconsistencies between the agreement on the record and the stipulated order. It wasn't until Father essentially prevailed at the ICA that he now comes to this court requesting that this court invalidate the settlement agreement based on the negotiation process, seemingly having buyer's remorse. However, the totality of the circumstances in this case all point to a voluntarily entered agreement, and that is for three main reasons. First, as Chief Justice has pointed out, both parties were represented by counsel. Second, the family court acted within the bounds of propriety when he facilitated or even encouraged settlement. And third, the record reflects the voluntary nature through the transcripts, the documents submitted, and in particular, the custody evaluator's involvement in the settlement negotiations.
Ms. Ziegler, we have a question from Justice Nakayama.
Good morning, Ms. Ziegler. Thank you, CJ. You emphasized that both parties were represented by counsel, but in fact, they were not represented by counsel when they went into the judge's chambers. Isn't that problematic that there wasn't, they weren't represented there and there wasn't a waiver?
I think in certain circumstances, it could be problematic, but in this case, it was not. And there's several reasons why. First, the fact that the parties were represented is significant because, as noted before, the attorneys, if they suspected that any actions were objectionable, should have placed that objection on the record. And there was multiple opportunities to do so. They could have stated the objection when counsel came back and put the agreement on the record. And there were also several subsequent filings in which an objection could have been placed. So I think that is a substantial factor in evaluating the court's conduct. But second, as Mr. Mitchell points out, there is only one place in the record that reflects that the judge actually did meet individually with Father. And so the Father's declaration is the only place for us to be able to evaluate the court's conduct. And as Mr. Mitchell points out, the court made a recommendation. And Father only speaks to the fact that the court made a recommendation regarding Father's overnights per week. The court suggested one overnight, and after a period of time, he would graduate to more overnights. And Father eventually agreed to that recommendation. But I think what's key to the court's recommendation is that it was actually in line with what the custody evaluator also recommended. The custody evaluator had submitted a report prior to trial that both parties had seen, and the custody evaluator did have extensive testimony, including his reasoning behind his recommendation for overnights. And the custody evaluator also recommended one overnight per week.
Ms. Ziegler, we have a question from Justice McKenna for you, and then Justice Wilson.
Thank you, Ms. Ziegler. And I have two questions, actually. First, you indicated there's only one place in the record that indicates that the court met separately with the father without counsel present. My first question is there any dispute that that actually happened? And my second question is, you indicated, and I believe the ICA also indicated, that counsel had agreed to the settlement, but I don't see in the record where the father actually stated on the record that he had agreed to the settlement. And I'm wondering whether or not there is any issue as to, and I believe it is pretty common practice when parties are present to have that agreement, the parties' agreement, also placed on the record. Is there anything in the record to indicate that counsel had father's authority in writing to agree to these settlement terms as required by Hawaii Revised Statutes Section 605-7? Because, as you know, counsel must have authority in writing for a settlement. And that is why courts routinely ask the parties whether they actually agreed to the settlement also. So please respond to my questions. Thank you.
As to your first question, Your Honor, I don't believe there's anywhere in the record where mother disputes that father met with the judge individually. With regard to asking the individual parties specifically whether they agreed to the settlement, the judge did not do that in this case. What happened was the parties came back on the record. The judge asked, were there discussions? Mother's counsel said multiple. Father's counsel said multiple. Mother's counsel represented that we have come to an agreement, and father's counsel said go ahead, meaning let's put this onto the record. So there was a colloquy between the judge and the counsel, but there was not a direct question to the parties. But there is indication in the transcripts that father understood and contributed to the settlement, and that's because as mother was putting the settlement on the record, father's counsel did chime in and clarify some of the terms along the way, but father himself also did. He spoke up while the settlement was being put onto the record, specifically with regard to telephone calls with his child, and participated in that way. So that certainly indicates between the counsel agreeing that we've come to an agreement and father's participation that he was aware of the terms of the settlement and had agreed to them.
What about the question of the written settlement authority? Was that required in these circumstances, or written settlement authority or direct oral confirmation? I think that was Justice McKenna's last question.
Right, and there was not at least there's not in the record a written confirmation. Whether that took place and was not submitted to the court, I do not know.
Very well. Justice Wilson, your question.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Ms. Ziegler, I wanted to get your position with respect to Rule 2.94. This is the rule of the Code of Judicial Conduct that says a judge shall not initiate, permit, or consider ex parte communications except in civil cases. A judge may, with the consent of the parties, confer separately with the parties, says confer separately with the parties and their lawyers in an effort to settle matters pending before the judge. And then the commentary indicates that there should be a clear consent. Now, there are cases, and you probably have seen them, like the Geiger case from California, the Hitchcock case from Iowa, where the courts look very carefully with great scrutiny at settlement communications that take place during trial. We don't have, correct me if I'm wrong, any cases that involve judges attempting to settle during trial. In Miho, there was a settlement effort just before trial. So my question is, do you think that this very, I think, clear statement in Rule 2.94 that the meeting with the parties for settlement purposes, it anticipates meeting with their lawyers as well, is something that would be of particular importance when we're talking about settlement during trial as opposed to just a settlement conference?
I think in the family court setting, Rule 16 is instructive, and that under Rule 16, I think the family court has authority to conduct settlement at any point. And that's because Rule 16 provides the family court substantial discretion to initiate conferences with the parties, and one aspect of that type of conference can be for settlement. And Rule 16 doesn't place a time limit on the court in calling those conferences. And that's in contrast to the Hawaii Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 16, that specifically labels it pre-trial conference. But Rule 16 of the Family Court Rules does not. And I think that that's important to give the family court judge that wide discretion to help facilitate the parties to come to a resolution, a compromise, agreement, and then especially in custody situations where the court's considering the best interests of the child.
We have a question from Justice Nakayama, followed from Judge Viola. Justice Nakayama.
Ms. Ziegler, why would a trial judge want to speak to a party outside the presence of the party's attorney?
Your Honor, I'm not sure in this instance why the judge did decide to do that. However, I think because the judge's recommendation that's reflected in the father's declaration is simply reiterating what the custody evaluator had already suggested, that although it may appear questionable for the court to have done that, what the court actually ended up doing was not questionable. And I think one other aspect to the court's meeting with the party that hasn't been fully addressed is really the timing of all of the circumstances and negotiations that took place. And this is where I actually disagree with Mr. Mitchell's rendition of the facts, because the record reflects that the counsel initially went in, they decided with the judge that they would make a concerted effort to settle. Father apparently went in individually with the judge, but the subsequent facts are very important, and that's that the parties were in the courtroom negotiating for 3 hours after the meetings with the judge occurred. And the custody evaluator was also present. So any influence the judge may have had on father is taken away by the fact that he was able to sit in the courtroom with the custody evaluator and come up with an agreement with mother, with both counsel present, and negotiate that agreement that ultimately occurred.
Very well. Judge Viola, then Justice McKenna.
Oh, thank you, CJ. Good morning, Ms. Ziegler. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
I would like you to respond to the question that Justice McKenna put to Mr. Mitchell about what would have happened if there were not, in fact, a settlement, assuming there were actually a settlement, if the trial had to resume. Would the judge have compromised his ability to be fair and impartial and to render a fair and impartial decision in this case?
In this case, I would say no. And that's because I think Mijo speaks to this issue when Mijo states that it is within the bounds of propriety for a court to give its inclinations and encourage settlement during the settlement conference. So the fact that the court did give his inclinations to father in their conference, I don't think that would, in an overall outlook on the case and looking at the totality of the circumstances, compromise his ability to finish the trial.
Justice McKenna.
Thank you. Ms. Ziegler, I believe I heard you indicate that you believe Family Court Rule 16 provides additional authority to this process that was followed by this family court judge to schedule a settlement conference during the trial, to start a settlement conference during the trial. But I've just taken a look at Family Court Rule 16, and it says that, the court may direct the parties to appear to discuss settlement, et cetera. But then it goes on to say that the court shall make an order that reflects what had taken place, and which limits the issues for trial to those not disposed of, et cetera. And such order, when entered, controls the subsequent course of the action unless modified at the trial to prevent manifest injustice. So it appears to me that the Family Court Rule 16 is actually a pretrial conference rule also, just as the civil rules are. But I'm wondering, is it still your position that Family Court Rule 16 actually allowed this process after hearing how, after what I've just explained to you?
I think so, Your Honor. I think that, that yes, there is the requirement that an order be set, but it does say that It should reflect what the matters that weren't settled. And in this case, I think the parties came to an agreement and settled all of the matters with regard to custody of their child. And I think giving the family court that wide discretion, he had heard the custody evaluator's report. He had seen all of the documents that were submitted prior to trial. So I think the family court probably had a very good idea of where the parties were at in this case and was hoping that they could come to an agreement and settle it at that point, which they did.
Actually, after lunch, wasn't father supposed to be able to cross-examine the custody evaluator? In other words, and there was a lot of discussion about who was going to pay for the custody evaluator having to return in the afternoon. So the custody evaluator had not been questioned by father's counsel. In addition, and I don't have the statute in front of me, but there is a rule, there's a statute that says that when the court is going to rely on a custody evaluator's report, the party should be allowed to cross-examine the custody evaluator.
Yes. So actually, Your Honor, the custody evaluator was father's witness. Although the parties had come to an agreement to choose that evaluator, father called him as his first witness. So father had actually finished his examination of the custody evaluator and mother was in the process of cross-examining.
Thank you for that clarification. I appreciate that. Thank you.
No, go ahead. Please finish your answer. Then I was going to ask about another subject. So if you had anything to add, go ahead.
I was just going to say mother did have an opportunity for some cross-examination prior to lunch.
Ms. Ziegler, help us understand the analysis you think we should apply with regard to the apparent ex parte discussion between the judge and the father. Is such a conversation ever appropriate without the approval of counsel or and the party? And if that's the case, that it's never appropriate for a judge to talk directly to the party without the party and their counsel's consent, what do we make of the fact that, you know, there's nothing on the record to indicate that such consent was provided in this case?
I think that's where the totality of the circumstances test is so important. There may be instances where that type of ex parte communication would be questionable, and then there may be instances where it's not. And so to give courts that wide discretion and the appellate courts the discretion to evaluate the entire circumstances that took place in the settlement negotiations is very important. My interpretation of the record is that the counsel were present when father went into the judge's chambers. So there was not consent on the record per se, but by allowing the party to go into judge's chambers and subsequently not lodging an objection to that, the counsel inherently gave their consent to those communications.
But again, there are no findings on that issue. Although wasn't there a proposed finding from the father, which was neither adopted nor rejected by the court that related to this matter?
Both parties did submit proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law after father had appealed to the family court, and then mothers were adopted. Or actually, excuse me, Your Honor, the family court adopted its own findings of fact that were actually not the same as mother and father's proposed.
I think Justice McKenna had a follow-up, followed by Justice Wilson. No, you didn't. Okay. Justice Wilson.
Yes, I was following up to your question, CJ, about the importance of consent. And I wanted to ask you, Ms. Ziegler, you have indicated that looking at the totality of the circumstances, the actions that took place after the discussion with the judge, that is the communications and the negotiations that took place after the judge's meeting with the father, would indicate that there was consent. On the other hand, isn't it the part of the purpose of making sure consent is gotten before there is a meeting with the judge, with the party. Isn't the purpose to ensure that a later consent isn't just, a later settlement isn't just a coerced settlement? In other words, I think the position the father's taking is he felt coerced in this ex parte communication with the judge. And if that's the case, wouldn't that color the later negotiations that lead to the ultimate settlement if the father did feel coerced?
I think there's two parts to my answer to that question. The first part is, again, father and judge, at least according to the record that we have, only spoke about his overnights per week. So if there were any indications that he was coerced into that, that shouldn't cancel out all of the other negotiations that took place with regard to the other elements of custody of their child. Second, I think the importance of the custody evaluator's presence in the subsequent negotiations is also very important. And the custody evaluator, as well as the judge, has the best interests of the child in mind when coming up with these types of parental decisions. And so having that custody evaluator there, if he had seen any red flags with regard to the best interests of the child or what father was agreeing to, he could then help the parties in coming to a different solution.
Thank you. Follow up on my earlier question. And again, I'm asking these questions with regard to the, you know, the issue of whether plain error should be noticed or not. And I believe you would have argued that the court shouldn't notice plain error with regard to the process that took place. But again, my understanding was that the father, when the court was doing findings of fact, the father had proposed a finding, and if I'm wrong, correct me, that would have recited, during a pause in examination, this court called a recess to talk to the attorneys about a possible settlement in chambers. After the attorneys left, the judge met with parties in chambers separately, first father, then mother. The court neither adopt that, or made any other findings on that issue. So my question to you is that a sufficient, effort to have put the issue of the propriety of that contact in play, so that it is in fact appropriate for us to address on appeal, even though not explicitly raised below beyond that or in the ICA?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And that's, again, goes back to the fact that the parties were represented by counsel. If the counsel had identified an objectionable conduct, it should have been explicit, and it easily could have been. It could have been right away, right when they were putting the settlement on the record, or there were other subsequent filings. Father filed a motion for reconsideration, and prior to that, he filed a specific response to the stipulated order that was submitted by mother, where he went through each of the provisions that he believed did not match what was entered into onto the record, and did not at all mention any question as to the court's conduct in coming to that agreement. There was a finding of fact 14 that says that the parties, the finding of fact that was actually adopted by the judge, stated that the parties had met with the judge and agreed to make a concerted effort to settle the matter. And father actually didn't object to that finding at the ICA. So I think there was plenty of opportunity for father to have objected to the court's conduct and did not.
What about the declaration of father does recite this conversation? I think you pointed to it before. At one point, I was invited into judge's chambers to conference with him. I was alone with the judge. You know, is there any obligation in your mind when a judge is presented with a suggestion of this type that an ex parte communication has occurred, that the judge at that point should address that in the context of the proceeding, whether making a disclosure, a filing of some kind, a finding of some kind? Is there any obligation at all at that point triggered for the judge who sees this kind of a suggestion being made, or is there no obligation in your view?
It certainly would have been helpful in this case, but I don't think the judge was under an obligation. And that's because the substantive content of the motion for reconsideration was, again, just pointing to those discrepancies between the stipulated order and the agreement entered onto the record. It did not actually mention any objection to the court's conduct. And I think although Father does include and mention that in his declaration, he doesn't necessarily make an explicit objection to it. He then goes into, again, the discrepancies that he identified, essentially asking the family court, please enforce that agreement that we had come to on the record and ignore some of these provisions in the stipulated order that I don't agree with.
Justice Wilson.
Ms. Ziegler, could you comment about the right that your client had, I believe, under Rule 2.94, the right that your client had to be consulted before the judge met with the opposing party? In other words, it appears that the judge decided to meet with the father without checking to see that it was okay with your client, the mother. Do you think that that would have been a necessary step?
Again, my impression of what happened, and of course the record is not crystal clear on this, was that both parties with their counsel were present when the individuals went into chambers. So again, mother's counsel had the same opportunity to object as father's counsel had, but did not.
Very well. I think you've got a couple minutes to go, Ms. Ziegler. Are there any points you wanted to make to sum up?
Your Honors, I will just circle back to the question that this court posed to both of the parties prior to oral argument, and that was whether the family court's involvement in the settlement process during trial invalidates the party settlement agreement. And the short answer is no. The parties came together, they negotiated, and they came up with a compromise agreement. So thank you, Your Honors, and thank you for the opportunity to present on this issue.
Very well. Thank you so much, Ms. Ziegler. We'll turn back to Mr. Mitchell for his rebuttal at this time. Oh, I'm sorry, Judge Viola.
Mr. Mitchell, question.
I'm sorry, you were asking. I wasn't sure if you were trying to get one last question for Ms. Ziegler or a beginning of a question for Mr. Mitchell. You had a question for Mr. Mitchell?
Yes, wanted to.
Very well. Mr. Mitchell, you have a question from Judge Viola. Please proceed.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Mitchell.
Good morning, Mrs. Viola.
I was hoping that you could just, as best you can, clarify exactly the argument that Father makes in this case as to why the purported settlement agreement should be invalidated. Is it because the father actually felt coerced into making an agreement? Is it because what's reflected in the record? The judge, as a matter of law, whether father is subjectively or not, it felt coerced. As a matter of law, what the judge did was coercive. Or is it because the judge violated perhaps some of the canons and the rules of the Code of Judicial Conduct?
Well, certainly. I hear a slight echo here. Does anyone else hear that? Okay. Well, certainly there is no direct evidence on the record of actual coercion. And the argument that's being made, that we're making, is that even...
Judge Viola, you might want to mute. I think that might... Oh, there you go. Thank you. Sorry. So sorry to interrupt, Mr. Mitchell. I was trying to address the echo there.
Even when you create the possibility of coercion, that too is as problematic as actual coercion. Because if the court is only looking for evidence of actual coercion to invalidate the judge's actions, that doesn't mean that we've captured all instances where coercion exists. And there are instances where the creation of the possibility of coercion is just as bad as actual coercion. And here what we have is at least one instance where the father on the record identifies the feeling he had that the judge was being adamant. And admittedly, the father refers to one particular issue, but that one particular issue is in the context of a much larger discussion that led to the father, as he said in his declaration, accepting what the judge recommended. And so it's not just whether or not there is actual evidence of coercion. It is also that when one creates the possibility of coercion, creates an environment where there's that risk, that is just as problematic. Hopefully that answers your question, Judge Viola.
I had one, Mr. Mitchell. Could you respond to Ms. Ziegler's suggestion regarding the direct conversation between the judge and father, that given the circumstances as reflected in the record of you know, parties in and out of, you know, lawyers in and out of the judge's chambers, folks negotiating in the courtroom for a long period of time, that in the circumstances here, and again, I'm not trying to, I hope I'm characterizing her argument correctly, it would be fair to infer that this was something that was done with the knowledge and or implicit consent of counsel and the parties, at least that we shouldn't find what happened problematic or require something more on the record. Could you address that issue?
Yes, I believe it may also have been, it may have been a question for Justice Wilson that led to that response. It is our position that notwithstanding the discussion that occurred between the parties after they came back from recess, we still have to deal with the facts of the parties not having notice of the judge's intent to terminate the custody evaluator's testimony. We still have to deal with the fact that the judge did not obtain consent of the parties on the record to have these in-chambers private discussions without counsel. And we still have to deal with the fact that at least one party came away from those discussions feeling that the judge was adamant and that he had no choice but to accept the recommendation because, as he put it, the judge was ultimately going to make the decision. The focus on those facts, I think, trumps the argument that after you come back from recess, there is, as Ms. Ziegler indicated, inherent consent. That does not validate invalid actions that occur before or immediately after recess and before recess. Those actions that occurred were the judge's responsibility, the judge's duty, and the judge did not exercise those properly.
Very well. Please continue.
We've talked quite a bit about the appearance of impropriety, and there are numerous instances of the appearance of impropriety here. As we've indicated, when the judge unilaterally and prematurely terminated the custody evaluator's testimony and the court's ability to hear a remainder of the evaluator's findings, in that instance, we have the appearance of impropriety. When the judge bypassed the party's lawyers to meet for an off-the-record discussion without first obtaining consent on the record and without counsel being present in chambers, the judge certainly was not acting within the bounds of propriety. And when during those off-the-record in-chambers meetings, the judge unilaterally discussed the judge's settlement inclinations with the parties without prior consent on the record and without having first heard the entirety of the custody evaluator's findings, the judge, again, was not acting within the bounds of propriety. Not only is the judge engaged in conduct that in itself creates at least the appearance of impropriety in violation of the code of conduct, but due process was certainly being denied in each instance to both parties. In short, the court exceeded the bounds of reason and disregarded the rules or principles of law or practice to the substantial detriment of the father. Now, indisputably, judges certainly have discretion to encourage settlement, but that discretion must be tempered with not acting in a manner that risks coercing any party into settlement. And I disagree with opposing counsel that MEO is applicable because MEO deals with pre-trial settlement discussions. And yes, if one looks at the totality of the circumstances surrounding the making of this agreement, one has to look at all of the actions before the recess. A settlement can be coerced in many ways, either by the power of the parties, by a strong judge in a settlement conference, or by inexorable trial dates. And in this instance, when the judge called a recess mid-trial before all the evidence had been heard and speaks to the parties alone without their counsel in chambers about his settlement inclinations, the totality of the circumstances surrounding the making of that agreement are immediately called into question, regardless of what happens during the discussions. And admittedly, agreed to the judge's settlement recommendations. And as stated in his declaration, he pointed out, quote, "I realize the judge was adamant. And of course, that the decision was ultimately his. I agreed to his recommendations." That statement in itself speaks to the totality of the circumstances in making the agreement. It suggests that the role the judge played in the in-chambers, off-the-record discussions without counsel present was abused his discretion by creating the possibility of coercion and denying both parties their due process rights. The ICA's opinion evidenced a grave error of fact where it interpreted the factual improprieties by the family court judge in its conclusion by placing responsibility solely on the father's trial counsel.
And what could the trial judge have done if the judge thought that settlement was something that should be thought of by the parties at that point based on what the judge heard during the course of the morning? In your view, what would the appropriate approach have been?
Well, certainly, to the extent the judge was intending after the recess to meet with counsel and meet with the parties and to discuss settlement, the judge should have made that clear on the record and should have made clear what the judge's role was going to be in those discussions, at the very least. But that was not done.
Very well. Anything further to wrap up today?
I'll simply conclude by saying the ICA's opinion didn't address many things. Why the family court didn't go on the record prior to the recess to inquire about the party's desire for settlement agreement. Why the record is devoid of the parties having made any semblance of an attempt before recess to discuss settlement. Why the family court unilaterally terminated the evidentiary hearing. And why after recess, the parties had suddenly, in the words of the mother's counsel, Ms. Ho, arrived at a settlement, clearly given the colloquy between the parties after recess that went on for some time, there wasn't an agreement. Parties kept discussing. And why the family court failed to ask the parties in open court whether they understood and agreed to the settlement terms, if they had questions about it, or if anyone was forcing, pressuring, or even threatening them into settlement. And based on these facts, the father respectfully requests that the court affirm the ICA's order to vacate the stipulated order and the order denying reconsideration. In addition, he requests that the court vacate the settlement agreement and remand the case back to the Second Circuit Family Court for retrial. Thank you, Chief Justice. Thank you, Justices.
Well, thank you, Mr. Mitchell and Ms. Ziegler, for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement. Once again, I want to restate the court's deep appreciation to our pro bono appellate counsel, Ms. Ziegler, Mr. Thomas, and Mr. Mitchell. You represent sort of the highest values of the bar by stepping forward to act in a pro bono capacity here, and we're very grateful for that. Thank you very much. Once again, the court will take this matter under advisement.